stumbled to the rear vestibule and squinted through the peephole at the center of the steel door. The lens probably hadn't been cleaned since 1967. I could make out no more than the hazy outline of a serial killer. I checked around to make sure the cat wasn't underfoot, then opened the door. "I'm from Med Supply, delivering the hospice stuff," the man said. "Oh, okay, come in." I lurched back to the TV room, the guy following with a cart stacked with a shower chair, oxygen pump, tanks, a breathing mask, and other paraphernalia. By the time we reached the den, Stephen was in the doorway. "Delivery," I said. Stephen surveyed the cart and its contents. "Oh, yeah, right. Where's the stuff go?" the man inquired. Stephen pointed to the master bedroom. Once inside the room, Mr. Hospice turned and began to explain each piece of equipment, how to set it up, and how it was used. The more granular the detail, the blanker the expressions on both mine and Stephen's faces. I stopped the guy mid-spiel, turned to Stephen, and asked, "Are you getting this?" My father-in-law shrugged and made a face. "Are you?" "Not really." The guy looked us both over, then inquired, "Excuse me, which one of you is the patient?" Stephen's lips broke into a sly smile. He rolled his eyes toward me and raised his eyebrows ever so slightly, another subtle shrug. I was a little surprised at the question, although I admit I wasn't looking too Marty McFly in my sweatpants and old t-shirt, a few days' growth on my chin. "Do you have the directions written down somewhere?" I asked the guy. "Sure," he said. He handed me an info sheet and a receipt. I fumbled in my pocket for a tip. Accepting it, he said, "Good luck. I'll find my way to the door." "Yeah, would you?" I said. "Didn't mind the cat." Once the guy was out of sight, Stephen turned to me and, incredibly, let loose a laugh. I managed to laugh, too. Stephen passed 3 weeks later, with his family gathered around. His wife, Corky, Tracy and her siblings, Michael, Lori, and Dana, their spouses, and all of our kids surrounded the bed in a semicircle. I scanned the adoring faces in the room. Much sadness, but no despair. A letting go, unforced and natural. I thought about the universality of this quiet ritual. People have been doing this for tens of thousands of years. In caves, in deerskin tents, in castles, in hospital rooms. This impulse for a communal, peaceful, and spiritual final observance is one of humanity's higher instincts. In our family vigil, there was love for him and for each other. A sincere aura of acceptance, which was a big part of Stephen's philosophy. The prevailing mood and spirit around Stephen, gratitude, was the very essence of the man. That's what he inspired in all of us. Always thankful for everything in his life. His gratitude was manifest in how much he loved his wife and family, and how appreciative he was for all of his experiences, positive and negative. A true optimist, he was known for his trademark assurance, "Just wait, kiddo, it gets better." The core lesson Stephen left me with was this. With gratitude, optimism becomes sustainable. Chapter 21, All Things Considered. The loss of my father-in-law in January, a few weeks after the abrupt departure from our Turks and Caicos vacation, marked the beginning of 2018, my annus horribilis. As the events of the year tumbled on, culminating in the trip to Africa, Stephen's message of gratitude was overshadowed by the wall of my perceived miseries and resentments, the spine surgery, my broken arm, the isolation and melancholy during recovery, the TV binging, the missed time with my family, the anger directed largely at myself. I recognize the value of Stephen's insights, but attempting to live his "it gets better" mantra was like trying to float a stone in water. It would drop and sink, the weight of my self-concern pulling me under along with it. Joyce, my Jungian analyst, advised, "Go with it, it's telling you something. Go deep, you can find truth in the depths." And so I searched the deep and found some treasure there. I realized that my gratitude, my optimism had been hijacked by fear. My broken arm eventually pointed me toward an understanding, a prolonged epiphany that wasn't so much about my physical and mental travails as it was about the fears they created. Africa taught me about fear in primal terms. I learned that there were things to be afraid of, things that went bump in the night. But in the months leading up to that trip, I got lost in more conceptual fears. Fear of my circumstances, fear of what the future could bring, and fear of my emotional reaction to it all. There's a homily that suggests that the opposite of fear is faith. Recalling the plaque on my father-in-law's desk, "Professional Fear Remover," I consider the role gratitude played in his life. I'm beginning to see that faith, or fear's opposite, can be expressed as gratitude, which has always been the bedrock of my optimism. I've spent sufficient time and energy dissecting what went wrong. I'm ready to reconnect with everything that went right. Good medicine. Something new happens today. My neurologist, Dr. Sue Brassman, conducts my quarterly Parkinson's exam, a methodical set of skill, movement, and cognitive assessments. She tests my reflexes with a rubber mallet, and the assault on my patella produces a bouncy response. I kick out like a rocket. After tapping my knees, she flips the rubber hammer and uses the other end as a scraping tool on the sole of my foot, checking the plantar reaction. My feet remain mostly numb, as do portions of my legs between the joints, hip to knee to ankle. So normally this poking and prodding doesn't bother me no matter how aggressively she digs at my soul. But today it hurts, which is the good news. That's your spine, she says. Less pressure on the cord, so it finally started to ease up. It's getting better. Getting better. Echoes of Stephen. But these are two words I've never heard from Sue. Her area of expertise is Parkinson's, a degenerative illness. While you won't die from Parkinson's, per se, you will die with it. Complications from the disease, such as the diminished ability to swallow, can lead to aspirating food or pneumonia. And these contributing factors can be lethal. Until we find a cure, and we will, getting better isn't part of the vernacular. Sue's words of encouragement don't refer to Parkinson's, but to my recovery from the spine surgery. It's in line with Dr. Theater's prognosis, 18 to 24 months for my body to heal from the invasive trauma of the procedure, and for the spine to achieve a new standard for normal. I'm right on schedule. I remind myself that this odyssey has not been about restoration, but about intervention. Not a reset to zero, though maybe at least back to where I was before the tumor advanced and Dr. Theater's knife caressed my spine. The damage done to my strength and mechanical function could not be erased, but I'm grateful that further deterioration was halted, and I'm no longer living with constant pain or facing a future of almost certain paralysis. I'll take my victories where I can find them, and today I feel, yes, better. Pleased that this other health crisis is in abeyance, Sue shifts the discussion back to Parkinson's. Nina's with me for today's appointment. A keen listener, and more likely than I am to retain details, she reports to Sue that she sees less foot dragging and shuffling in recent months. Tracy, Nina, and Sue are the first witnesses to any change, large or small. I'm humbled by their efforts and caring attention. Purely by virtue of the fact that I'm the one actually living it, my knowledge of the disease is deeper than theirs, but not by much. Luckily for me, they know I'm not the sum total of my symptoms. It's a good visit and a positive assessment. All the boxes are checked. My current combination of PD meds seems to be working. My blood pressure is stable. And my sleeping has improved. Another key factor to this relative wellness is my continuing physical therapy sessions with Ryan. Now familiar with the regimen, I find moments at home, at work, and out in the world to rotate my hips, knock off a quick set of ab contractions, or sneak in some calf stretches, while naming all the Beatles albums in order of release. I feel appropriately fit. That doesn't mean I'm moving in any way resembling normal. I still fall once or twice a day, often more, but I've learned to fall more efficiently and less dangerously. I must simply accept this as part of my routine. I've also learned to accept the need to consult an inventory of options before I make a move. There's a drink on the table in front of me. I need to carry it across the room. Do I stand first and then pick up the drink from the table? Or should I pick up the drink first? With my left hand? Is it stable? Which foot should I lead with? Depending on how I'm oriented, the left foot may be preferable. But if it fails in the process, my stride on the right will suffer. If I don't fall during this mission, I will at very least spill the drink. This creates more choices. Should I take the direct route across the carpet, or do I stick to the room's perimeter, like a mouse? I'll go with the latter, so that when I do spill, it's a quick wipe with a paper towel instead of a bill from the carpet cleaner. Or it could land on my face and break my nose. Choices. I have this conversation with myself thousands of times a day. One of me usually knows what he's talking about. Hollywood ending. 2019 offers a reset, presenting opportunities to patch up a few still tender wounds from the prior year. My agent, Nancy Gates, receives a call from Spike Lee's office. Netflix is offering to fund a pickup day on Spike's production See You Yesterday, Nancy tells me. This is a film shoot I missed on that pivotal day in August when I fell and broke my arm. The first Saturday in February, I traveled to a location at a high school in the Bronx. The director, Stefan Bristol, greets me on the classroom set with joy and relief. Stefan is young and dynamic, and I can tell by the cast and crew's devotion that he knows exactly what he's doing. Gaffers, grips, production assistants, and the other actors introduce themselves, to shake my hand with seeming reverence or take a quick selfie. They're treating me like Jimmy Stewart. Am I that old? Anyway, I love it. This is going to be fun. I'm playing a high school science teacher. It's the final day of the school year, and I'm chiding two of my best students, Eden Duncan Smith and Dante Critchlow, on their joint senior presentation, wherein they assert the possibility of time travel. I give them a B+. In answer to the protestations, I insist, if time travel were possible, it would be the greatest ethical and philosophical conundrum of the modern age. After the students exit, I mutter, time travel, great Scott. Obviously, there's value in having me utter that line. Yeah, it's an inside joke, but it's a clever one, in a well-crafted script. The film had officially wrapped production last fall, so it flattered and pleased me greatly that they would reassemble the cast and crew for one day just to pick up the scene. As the resolution to my busted arm no-show, it was an ending right out of the movies. Or better put in golf terms, it's a mulligan. A do-over. A breakfast ball. What happens in Vegas? I'm shouting into my iPhone at Tracy as I navigate a raucous Las Vegas casino at happy hour. Sorry, honey, I'm taking a shortcut through the slot machines. To the blackjack tables? She knows me. No, I'm meeting the guys for dinner. I may play later. Okay, but if you play, promise me you'll win. I'll speak to management. She laughs. How was golf today? Did you play well? How did I play? I chortle. Terrible. Bad. Really bad. Really bad? The worst. I fell a couple times. Sliced some shots into the succulents. I lost about 20 quality golf balls. Tracy pauses, confused. Why are you so chipper? Honey, I'm golfing again. Every year, usually in February, when there's no golf in the Northeast, George Harlan and I and a fourth we pick up. Last year it was my brother Steve. This year it's Harlan's friend James Bradbeer, who answers to Brad, head to warmer climes to play a few rounds. Previous trips took us to Florida and Pebble Beach. Last year in Los Angeles was the last time I played, pre-back surgery. It was a debacle, and I haven't played since. Now we're in Las Vegas. My return to the links with the guys has special meaning, even though I didn't play well this morning, our first round of the trip. We picked a beautiful course, winding through craggy hills and mesas. Because it's so arid, there's very little grass on the fairway. Ideally, you want to hit the ball long, far enough to fly the scramble and drop onto the green, or at least under the fringe. A few of the holes were too daunting, so I sat them out, distracting myself with the desert flora and fauna, clusters of cacti and winter flowers showing off. At the fifth hole, I spotted a coyote slinking through the rocks that lined the cart path. Arriving at the seventh tee, I encountered a roadrunner. You can't make this stuff up. Note to self, watch for falling anvils. I hadn't been sure that I'd make this trip, or that I would ever play golf again. But I'm here. I take the sighting of the roadrunner as a good omen. Two holes ahead of the coyote. Meep, meep. The next day, we're scheduled to play a mountain course regarded by the golfing press as a true test of skill. It's an hour's drive south of Las Vegas, and even though we have a noon tea time, we leave the hotel at 9 o'clock to allow for a stop on the way. Harlan has a friend who lives near Henderson, a gentleman that all three of us have an individual connection with, retired Senator Harry Reid. Obviously, George knows the senator and has dealt with him many times, both as a political operative and as a journalist. Harlan first met him in 2001. A fan of his books, Reid, along with former Senator Tom Daschle, invited Harlan to Capitol Hill to talk crime novels and politics. It was the beginning of a lasting friendship. My first contact with the senator came in the summer of 2006, when his office reached out to me during my summer vacation on Martha's Vineyard. Senator Reid came on the line to solicit my involvement in backing congressional midterm candidates who were pro-stem cell research. I felt privileged to be in a position to make a difference. I hit the campaign trail that fall and agreed to a media blitz. Amazingly, all the candidates we supported during that midterm election won their seats, ushering in 7 years for Harry Reid as majority leader and renewed enthusiasm in Washington for scientific freedom and advancements in research. We did some good work. I'm proud of it. This morning's side trip is a bonus. Mr. Reid is a gracious host and a gifted raconteur. Listening to his stories, we almost lose track of time. Harlan glances at his watch and announces we have to go if we're going to make our tea time. We thank the senator, pile back into the car, and hurry to the course. In spite of yesterday's mediocre play, I feel encouraged and excited. Maybe I'll get lucky on some challenging shots. It's a gorgeous morning in the high desert, but chilly in the low 50s, about 10 degrees cooler than the previous day. I have a few stumbles, no serious falls, and I'm able to execute full swings, albeit with varying results. Satisfied with the holes we played, and feeling a chill we weren't dressed for, we decided to head in for lunch after one last hole. Both George and Brad launched decent shots on either side of the fairway. Harlan addresses the ball and spanks it straight down the middle, a typical Coven golf shot. I'm the last to go, as usual. But something tells me this shot will be momentous. This ball's got eyes. It knows where to go. And sure enough, my swing is pure. The ball explodes from my club head and rockets down the center of the fairway, flying over Harlan's ball by a good 5 yards. It's the shot of my life. As I walk past Harlan's ball, I point to it and say, "Nice shot." And in the parlance of the game, "Harlan, you're away." "No fair," he says. "You have a titanium arm." We enjoy lunch in the clubhouse, talk golf and politics, and review life's rich pageant. All the while, something remarkable is happening outside. It's snowing. We comment on the irony that we left the northeast to go to the desert southwest, where big chunky flakes are currently drifting from the sky. Soon the entire course is blanketed in pure cleansing snow. The morning's magic is sealed and sanctified. Apparently the snow extends all the way to the Vegas Strip, which could use some sanctifying. I double bogeyed that final hole of the morning, even with a towering tee shot. It wasn't a rocky moment. I can't putt worth a damn. But it doesn't matter. The day held more important meaning. In the months since our golf trip, I haven't played much. The progress of my game has been mitigated by my physical regression. I'm at peace with that. Golf gifted me with almost 20 years of abundant memories. The friendships remain, which is the best takeaway. I gave golf a shot. It was a hell of a shot. I'm away. Exit laughing. Wither my golf game. Wither the second act of my career. The trip to Vegas was reward enough for the years I put into the game. Or should I say the years the game put into me. But the same can't be said for the final phase of my showbiz career. The Good Wife had spoiled me with its great writing, genius cast, and the opportunity to inhabit a multifaceted character without the onus of being number one on the call sheet. The producers were willing to accept my limitations, while astutely exploiting my strengths. Somehow I made the calculation that if I could do that many guest shots and consistently perform well, maybe I was ready to do a series again. The rest is sort of a blur. Several years ago, upon mentioning to my agents that I might be up for headlining a show, they immediately put me together with two young writers, both eager and thrilled to be working with me. Emboldened by the positive reaction to my role on Curb, we decided not to shy away from PD and pitched a show based on the experiences recounted in my first two books, basically a dad with Parkinson's. We called it The Michael J. Fox Show. Seinfeld was already taken. Having heard nothing more than the concept and a few personal anecdotes, every network offered to buy the show during the pitch meeting. That's not normal. Caught up in the incredible velocity of the process, I found myself committed to 22 episodes at NBC. The deal was made without the inclusion of my partner, Nell. It was my grievous mistake in not making sure I had someone who was looking out for my interests, specifically. I didn't have the energy or the time, given my responsibilities as lead actor of the show, to execute the oversight that someone with an eponymous television series should be prepared to deliver. We shot a good pilot. Betsy Brandt, Wendell Pierce, and the rest of the cast were hugely talented. But very quickly there was trepidation on the part of the network, as if the execs suddenly awoke, slapped their collective foreheads, and gasped, "Oh, he really does have Parkinson's." I sensed them observing me tremoring during rehearsal and whispering to their colleagues, "What's wrong with him?" I think Parkinson's freaked them out, which was problematic because it was the premise of the show. The first season was also the last. Ultimately, I didn't have the focus or the bandwidth to administer the life support the show would need to make it. That's on me, and I'm fine with that. As I've said before, I can play anyone as long as they have Parkinson's. It's especially true when I'm playing a version of myself. As if I'd never gone away, The Good Wife has me back for a few episodes during their final season. It is a tonic. Over the next couple of years, I accept two guest shots on other network shows that are not as satisfying. These are the last acting roles I've done, and most likely the last I will do. I feel no sadness in making this prediction. Like Tracy said after we sold our house in the country, the one the kids had grown up in, this house owes us nothing. I feel the same way about my second act. And golf, too, for that matter. They owe me nothing. They both took me further than I expected, to places I may never visit again. There was a variable that hadn't been present in the Scrubs to Rescue Me to Good Wife run. In those shows, I had figured out a way to incorporate my extraneous movement, my spasticity, even my rigidity. I didn't have to move much to play any of those characters. A chair, a cane, a desk to lean on. I could get around the set without calling attention to my limitations. But not being able to speak reliably is a game-breaker for an actor. Difficulty in forming words is one problem. The other is remembering the words I meant to say. Previously in my career, I had no problem with line memorization. In fact, as I've said about the days of Family Ties, I enjoyed a near photographic memory. But recently that changed. It's a different story on these last two dramas in which I play lawyers. Legalese is difficult to learn and speak, never mind understanding what the hell I'm saying. First, I agreed to do a 5-episode arc in Designated Survivor, playing a white shoe Washington, D.C. attorney, representing the cabinet as they try to remove the President of the United States via the 25th Amendment. For me, survivor is the key word. While this role is challenging and fun creatively, it is a self-inflicted assault on my brain and body. Not only do I endure a perfect storm of symptoms, but I have to film during February and March in Toronto. Snow and ice, and long distances to walk between sets in the enormous warehouse studio. I don't know yet, but I'm a little more than a month away from surgery on my spine. In the complicated plot, my character is both ally and adversary of the president, played by Kiefer Sutherland, an old friend of mine. We worked together in the 80s on Bright Lights Big City. A terrific guy, at once folksy and urbane. Kiefer welcomes me on the set. A happy reunion. As I'd remembered, Kiefer likes to work fast, briskly, picking up on the other actors' cues with very little air between the lines. Although I enjoy this quick and snappy style, I just can't oblige. Whereas in the party of the second part leads immediately into habeas corpus, then right into posse comitatus. I'm lost and have to start again. I cannot get through a scene without having to stop and with confusion and embarrassment call out to the script supervisor, "Line, please!" I had enjoyed this form of lexicon in the past. I'd nailed it on Boston Legal and The Good Wife. I loved the musicality of it, and I had no problem rolling out the legalese. But this is different. I know the editor will save my ass, and he does. But it has not been a pleasant experience. I no longer have the facility, and the thrill is gone. On The Good Fight, a spinoff of The Good Wife, I am Lewis Canning again, so that familiarity is helpful. But in the few years since I last embodied the character, much has changed with the show and with me. The production is leaner and on a tighter budget, with a shorter production schedule and more scenes to film in a day. They can't allow me the rest and recuperation between scenes and film days that they've been afforded me on the larger Mother show. The upshot is that I play 3 6-page scenes in the course of a day, covered in such a way that I have to perform all 3 scenes at once, 18 pages at a time, instead of shooting the scenes individually. It crushes me. One more reference to Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Leonardo DiCaprio, playing a cowboy actor who's seen better days, keeps screwing up his lines while doing a guest shot on a popular TV western. Furious at himself over his chronic inability to remember and deliver the dialogue, we've seen him going over and over the script and scenes prior, he retreats to his boxy dressing room trailer, takes a stance in front of the mirror, and berates himself viciously over his abject failure. I feel his pain. I've obviously been there. But weighed against everything else in my life, I don't find it worthy of self-excoriation. I'm not sure it ever did, but especially now, my work as an actor does not define me. The nascent diminishment of my ability to download words and repeat them verbatim is just the latest ripple in the pond. There are reasons for my lapses in memorization, be they age, cognitive issues with the disease, distraction from the constant sensations of Parkinson's or lack of sensation because of the spine. But I read it as a simple message. An indicator. There's a time for everything, and my time of putting in a 12-hour workday and memorizing 7 pages of dialogue is best behind me, at least for now. In fairness to myself and to producers, directors, editors, and poor beleaguered script supervisors, not to mention actors who enjoy a little pace, I enter a second retirement. That could change, because everything changes. But if this is the end of my acting career, so be it. Tattoo you. I got a tattoo in Soho from an artist with the sobriquet Mr. K. It's a fine line black and gray sea turtle gliding palmward along the inside of my right forearm. I posted a picture of it on Instagram, straight from the parlor chair. The typical reaction from followers was, "You got a tattoo? Who gets their first tattoo at 58? Good question. I have an answer. That would be me. Given the prevailing cultural norm, everybody is inked these days, I consider the absence of a tattoo on my body as a commensurate act of rebellion. This badge of ink doesn't exactly make me the illustrated man. And Tracy says if I get one more of these things, she'll kill me. So why now? It all leads back to the turtle. It was New Year's Eve 1999, the eve of a new millennium. Our family was on vacation in the Virgin Islands. Tracy and I were alone on the beach at the end of the day, and I was distracted. I was struggling to decide whether to continue with another season of Spin City or retire and create a research-based Parkinson's Foundation. I waded into the ocean for the year's last swim. Snorkeling aimlessly through the grassy edge of the reef, I suddenly found myself beside a large and battered sea turtle. Something had taken a chunk out of its right front fin and a nasty scar marked its beak. We swam together for a while. This guy had obviously been through a lot and had earned the right to go where he wanted. He imbued me with a measure of his will. Sure, it might be easier to just flow with the current, but sometimes you have to risk charting a new course. 2 decades later, as I deliberated how best to go forward from the emotional and physical battering I'd been through, I thought of that stoic turtle. Getting tatted was a permanent gesture of respect and appreciation. In the same way I'd used the x-ray of the arm to illustrate what had happened to me, the turtle tattoo made the invisible visible. It created a visual record of the power of resiliency and the will to survive. My turtle swims through 5 rings, ripples of water representing the 5 decades of my life. The rings also signify emergence, both his and mine. I have come through a difficult period, and now I swim in calmer waters. I have battle scars and a tattoo to show for it. Chapter 22, Shake It Off. Every November in New York City, the Fox Foundation hosts a big gala. An enthusiastic crowd gathers to hear great musicians like The Who, Elvis Costello, Chris Martin, James Taylor, Paul Simon, John Mayer, Sheryl Crow, Dave Matthews, John Fogerty, Joan Jett, Bon Jovi, and Brad Paisley. We call the night "A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Cure Parkinson's," so naturally we include comedians. Dennis Leary, Ricky Gervais, David Letterman, Jon Stewart, Chris Rock, Jim Gaffigan, Amy Schumer, Robin Williams, John Mulaney, Colin Quinn, Tina Fey, and a rose gallery of others. The guests are laughing, happy, and well-fed. It's a pricey ticket, so we raise a lot of money, about $5 million in the night, all of which goes to research. The event is underwritten by a board of directors. Once we have you there, we stay out of your wallet. No auctions or further calls to contribute. It's a party to celebrate the year's progress, and a meet and mingle with the supporters of our cause in the Parkinson's community. Each year at the benefit, we impart the Foundation's mission and methods in the form of a short film. This is always co-produced by Nell and me, with Nell also contributing her considerable talents as a director, a duty which she handles deftly, with empathy and insight. This year's film tells the story of Jimmy Choi, a Parkinson's patient and technology executive from Bolingbrook, Illinois. To say he's an activist and a fundraiser would sell him short. He's a part-time ninja for Parkinson's. His experience with the disease is personal, and to many PD patients, including and especially me, particularly powerful. As Jimmy opens up during his interview with Nell and me, much of what he describes sounds familiar. Like I used to say when I was a kid, it takes one to know one. I was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's in 2003, at the age of 27, Jimmy begins. I didn't tell anyone I had PD for a while, not even my wife. For the next 7 years, I ignored Parkinson's. I gained 70 pounds, which didn't help my deteriorating health. I needed a cane to walk. Clearly, I had just given up. I think echoes of my past demons. I was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's at the same stage in life, in my late 20s. Although I shared the news with Tracy, I kept it from most. Jimmy continues. Then I had 2 aha moments. The first, 8 years into my disease, I was going down the stairs carrying my 9-month-old son, Mason. I thought, I don't need my cane. I've got the railing. My son was tucked under my arm. One of my legs didn't move with me. In my mind, I thought it was moving, but my legs stayed behind as I approached the second or third step. I fell the entire length of the staircase. Fortunately, I was able to keep Mason above me and he was not injured. But it was startling, to say the least. My home had been my safe zone, the place where I could let my symptoms be free. I had the false sense that nothing bad could happen inside my house. buffer by the only people who knew I had Parkinson's. I think, this is so eerily close to my experience. Disastrous falls, the challenge presented by everyday routines. Similarly, I felt a false sense of security, more like hubris, in the privacy of my home, until I snapped my arm. Now I can't walk into my own kitchen without having flashbacks. He probably feels the same way when he travels those stairs. The worst part wasn't hitting the ground, he said. It was looking up at my wife and daughter. I'll never forget the expression of horror on their faces. It made me think, what have I reduced myself to at this moment? I've become a burden, a safety hazard. Just holding my son, I put both of us in danger. This part of Jimmy's story reminds me of my last hangover, and the look on Tracy's face, in her case, boredom, that caused me to stop drinking and face life with PD and a family. Another kind of awakening. It struck me right then. I had to change, Jimmy states. I didn't like the way I was living. I had no idea what to do about it, but if I continued on this way, it wouldn't be good. It's spooky to hear him say this. I had this moment too, and it was powerful and revelatory. Jimmy continues, I began losing the weight, eating better, and taking walks with my family. But I wasn't pushing myself physically. Then I read about a Parkinson's patient who had finished a marathon, and it really inspired me. Before my diagnosis, I had been an athlete, captain of my high school football team, a wrestler, and a golfer. I decided to enter a 5K. Then I ran a 10K, and soon a half marathon. I was hooked. I couldn't believe how much better I felt with regular, rigorous exercise. I was able to get rid of the cane. That's right, I thought. Just do the next right thing. Your family will see you, stand up, step forward, and carry on. I set a goal to train for the 2012 Chicago Marathon, only a few months away. Unfortunately, the race was closed and there was no way to register. But Jimmy found there was. The Fox Foundation, like other charities, is granted a limited number of bibs in marathons and other big races for runners to raise money for our cause. Jimmy continued, this was the first time I'd been in touch with the foundation since I avoided dealing with my Parkinson's for so long. Soon I was talking to Stephanie at Team Fox. She had one entry bib left for the Chicago Marathon. I'd always thought that bib was meant for me. I ran the marathon for Team Fox, and this was my second aha moment. Not only did it connect me with the foundation, which is now such a big part of my life, but it also gave me the impetus to come out to my friends and family. I had to explain why I was raising money for Parkinson's research. I was blown away by the reaction. My friends and family listened to my story, and they were really there for me. It's harder for a guy like Jimmy to reveal his diagnosis than it was for me. And it was definitely hard for me. So I can just imagine how it was for him. It's a very personal choice. Very scary to go public. That first expression of support from family and friends means everything. In only a month's time, Jimmy said, I raised $5,000. After years of hiding, I opened up about my story and educated others about the disease. I did all this in 4 weeks, versus the previous 8 years when I did nothing. It was the most positive I felt in all the years since I was diagnosed. The Fox Foundation did that for me. Jimmy's wife, Cheryl, adds, something clicked. Just signing up to be part of something, to raise money for research, suddenly made it so much easier for us to talk to our friends and family. Jimmy has Parkinson's, we finally told them. We're dealing with it. It didn't feel so scary anymore. Jimmy is smiling. I went to my first Fox Foundation gathering not long after the Chicago Marathon. It was the Team Fox MVP dinner in New York City to celebrate top fundraisers. I sat down at a table with a group of strangers, other PD patients who have been my friends ever since. Suddenly I realized that there were people out there just like me, living with Parkinson's. Everybody had little bits of information and advice that I could use to make myself better, that I could learn from. And soon I knew enough to return the favor to others. The whole sense of a Parkinson's community suddenly came into play. The number of people we met at that first Fox event really jolted us. So many amazing patients and their families. We were inspired and excited by everyone on the staff at your foundation. Cheryl and I knew then, we've got to do more. These people are busting their tails to find a cure for Parkinson's. We need to do more because this is who I am now. Patients like Jimmy take away the stigma, the common belief that Parkinson's is an old person's disease, that young people don't have it. Before we launched the foundation, the young onset community had not exercised its full potential to dynamically increase awareness, advocate politically, and raise money. The foundation gave voice to their message. PD is here, it's real, and it can affect you or someone you know. I've now finished 16 marathons for Team Fox, and over 100 half marathons. The event Cheryl and I started in Illinois, the Shake It Off 5K, has raised nearly $400,000. My body is strong. I still have symptoms and bad days, but I'm managing Parkinson's better than ever. On my daughter's urging, I trained and auditioned for American Ninja Warrior, her favorite show. I'm glad I did. I've competed on Ninja Warrior 4 times now, and it's been a blast. I remember you saying once that the best expert on this disease is the patient. A few years ago, I agreed to join the Fox Foundation's Patient Council with 34 other patients from around the country at different ages and stages of their disease. The folks at the Foundation truly want to know what's important to us, our daily challenges, and what the Foundation can do to help us improve our lives now. I also use the Foundation's online tool, Fox Trial Finder, to match me with available clinical trials. More trials mean more shots on goal. I appreciate Jimmy's hockey metaphor. It's an apt one, because that's what we're about. Firing at this thing from every direction, slap shots, wrist shots, long shots, it's all about getting the puck across the line. We are relentless, and Jimmy embodies our patient-centric drive to succeed and find a cure. Jimmy sums it up. I know I have to live with this disease for many years to come, and I have to do my best to take care of myself. I want to be strong for my daughter and son. I want them to know that I'm trying my best. If they ever get in a position in life where they're faced with some hardship, they can think, what would my dad do? I obviously relate to Jimmy's desire. The mistake I make at times is to assume that my kids are looking at what I can't do and not what I can do. They see through the disease and they see their dad. Everybody I've met through Team Fox, the patients, families, and the Foundation staff, has a mindset to beat Parkinson's. I've surrounded myself with a positive circle of people there to support me. No matter which way I fall, they're going to push me back up. That's been a huge key to where I am now. Later, I tell Jimmy how touched I am by his testimonial. With a lump in my throat, I share with him, "You pushed me back up a few times, brother. You don't even know it. There have been times I've thought of you, all that you've achieved, all that you've given back to the Foundation, and it's helped me get through something. I've had a lot of mentors in my life, but I don't have many heroes. You're one of them." A solid foundation. Our film about Jimmy Choi is one of the highlights of our gala event. The crowd is already attentive, responsive, and enthusiastic, and Jimmy's energy kicks it up to another level. Steve Winwood plays. The music is great, and the comics are hilarious. At some point after dinner, Tracy and I come on stage, stand at the podium, and thank people. I always have a head full of things I want to say, and Tracy, though sometimes shy at a microphone, is not averse to going off script and getting a laugh at my expense. If she leaves me an opening, I return the favor, a la Sonny and Cher with less sequence and fringe. We go back and forth for a minute or two and then realize we have business to attend to and return to our script on the teleprompter. I'm scanning 1,000 faces in the ballroom. I'm thinking, look at what we did. Nell, Debbie Brooks, and I, squatting in our former Spin City offices 20 years ago, laying out the blueprint for the Foundation, had no idea it would grow to this extent. I don't often get this kind of perspective. Back in 2000, when we announced our first round of scientific grants, brain research was promising but significantly underfunded. We leapt in with full enthusiasm. Many people in this room have shown tremendous commitment since the Foundation's inception. Board members and their associates, beyond generous in their support. Our talented staff led by Debbie, Todd Shearer, and Sohini Chowdhury. And the dedicated scientists who are working every day to unlock this disease. There are patients with their families here tonight, too. And many are actual participants in our process. Signing up for clinical trials, serving on our councils and committees, engaging in advocacy and community outreach, and fundraising through Team Fox, the special arm of the Foundation highlighted in this evening's film. Our staff in New York helps to guide and support these community fundraisers, 6,400 separate events and counting worldwide. It's a badge of honor around our office or at any of our meetings and conferences to be identified as a Team Fox member. This group of volunteers have raised nearly $100 million for the Michael J. Fox Foundation, greatly contributing to our overall success. It's incredible that in less than 2 decades, the Fox Foundation has funded $1 billion in research. $1 billion is a lot of money, and 20 years seems like a long time. But in research terms, we're high velocity. In the quest to cure Parkinson's, we're absolutely certain we are at the tip of the spear. I'm looking at the sea of faces again, and it strikes me that whenever I'm beating myself up over a personal setback or feeling ineffective in my life, I need to reflect on this moment, this panoramic view in front of me, which is the result of an instinct to help, to embrace a community, and to try to make a difference. Good things can come from bad things. Suddenly, the gal audience laughs. I snap out of my reverie and realize that Tracy just said something funny. I missed it. I'm sure she'll be happy to repeat it in the car ride home. Touch of Gray. The sentinel crow atop the highest bough of our old cedar tree emits a series of sharp caws that send the songbirds, starlings, and sparrows bursting out of the surrounding treetops, flitting and flapping in retreat. It's not the crow that they're afraid of. It's what the crow is afraid of that hasn't been a panic. A hawk is tracing lazy circles in the sky above our neighborhood. The bird logic must be, if we all move at once, there is safety in numbers. I'm observing this from my back porch. A pair of binoculars are close at hand, a Father's Day gift for my kids. I'm about to reach for them when Gus comes out to the porch. I glance at him in acknowledgement and watch as he does his own slow, hawk-like circle. Once he's ready, he lowers himself gingerly to a sitting position beside me. I recognize the geriatric caution that goes into this effort, hovering over the landing zone. The last foot and a half of butt drop, all gravity and luck. I'm watching the birds, I tell him. After a beat, he looks at me and takes in the yard as if he understands what I'm talking about. Maybe not. I hear the high beep sound of the hawk, which spooks a bunny out of the hedgerow. Gus lets go a low woof and initiates a getting up motion. I laugh and he stops. You're not chasing that rabbit. You're an old man. He is an old man. Let's face it, he's physiologically older than I am. He seems to have lost muscle mass in his hindquarters. His back legs don't serve him as well as they once did. Getting in and out of cars, negotiating obstacles, running, chasing rabbits. He has some tenderness in his hips, and his gait is compromised. He is slower, and he can be a little mopey. He's a big dog, so it's obvious to us when he's lost weight. 115 pounds in his prime, he's a little less than that now. We have to make an extra effort to keep him north of the 100 mark. Cognitively, he's still solid. He impresses me as having a logical, intuitive, maybe instinctive understanding of sequencing. Water, walk, food. Who's coming home next? How soon they'll be here and what car they'll be driving. He knows what's on his mind. He grasps the concept of cause, effect, and consequence. Does that mean he understands past, present, and future? I think a dog is living all three at once. I've tried that. It doesn't work. Parkinson's has taken away my sense of smell, but I'm told by my disgruntled family that Gus is a little more aromatic these days. We'll be watching TV and suddenly noses crinkle and everyone clears out. I look to make sure Gus is actually in the room, so I know for sure it wasn't me. Beyond all this old yeller boy and his dog stuff, there are some real parallels. I see Gus getting older, grayer, shaggier, thinner. I'm pretty much the same, although I wish I had his waist. Gus is 12. Shouldn't be old for a dog, but it is. Thus providing the rationale behind that full formula of 7 human years to 1 dog year. Probably manufactured to make us feel better about the brevity of a dog's lifespan. Given Gus's size and his genetic melange of breeds, he's not expected to live much past 14. The way I see it, though, that's negotiable. Whatever the threat, I can attempt to forestall. There are effective meds for everything that ails a canine. If Gus needs an operation, he has a great vet. If a time comes when he can't use his hind legs, I'll have rear wheels made for him, a cart he can propel with his front paws. Gus puts aging and ultimately mortality into perspective for me. I've availed myself of each of these options in my medical history. Standard cocktail of PD meds, surgery on my back and on my arm, and the use of a wheelchair. All to extend life and hopefully make the remainder of the ride as comfortable as possible. I read somewhere that there's a red sea urchin, native to the South Pacific, that has been documented to live upward of 250 years. A freaking sea urchin? That spiny prick gets to hang out in the ocean for 250 years and my dog Gus gets a dozen or so to roam the earth? Who do I see about that? Chapter 23, Midnight in the Garden. Do you smell pot? Tracy's asking over the music. Do I smell what? Pot? Do you? An exaggerated nod. We're at Madison Square Garden. The band Vampire Weekend has sold out the house, which is impressive for a quirky, up-tempo jam band that once toured with the Bernie Sanders campaign. No, I can't smell it. I'd laugh and point at my nose to make a shaky hand sign. For some Parkinson's patients, the smell deficit is total. But for me, I can still pick up a faint trace of scent. Walk me blindfolded into a horse barn and I can download enough olfactory info to prompt a where's the pony. But tonight, nada. I can't whiff the weed. No question that sensory deprivation is a loss, but it may even predate my diagnosis. So it's been absorbed into normalcy. My sense of taste is also affected, but strangely not my appetite, which accounts for my dad bod. In the context of all the losses I've experienced in my 29 years of living with this disease, these symptoms are the least of my problems. Still, for a 58-year-old man at a rock concert, if only for nostalgia's sake, the perfume of ganja would be nice. I don't smoke myself, but who knows? Maybe I'll catch a contact buzz while I wait for my own non-psychotropic drugs to kick in. Parkinson's meds entirely buzzless. Tracy, having easily decoded my hand signals, taps the tip of her own nose and smiles. Too bad. The band is killing it. With a world-class guitarist, two drummers, and a wickedly deaf bass player, their beat is complex and infectious. On my left, two of our three daughters, Skylar and Esme, are swaying to the music. Sam is in Los Angeles, and Quinn is working. The world of advertising never rests. To my right, Tracy is by now flat-out grooving, soaking the music into her pores and letting it out with paroxysms of hip-swinging, arm-waving, and ass-shaking. The girl can dance. Me, not so much. My dancing has never been good, and my best moves are unintentional. Tracy dances at every concert we attend, and this factored into my decision to be here tonight. It takes an effort to make it out to a big public event, having nothing to do with being famous or recognized, but more with simple logistics. A regular at Madison Square Garden for years, I've been here for big fights, Rangers and Knicks games, dozens of concerts. We've seen the Rolling Stones, U2, Pearl Jam, Springsteen, and one Friday night, my daughters even got me here to see Katy Perry. I know most of the security staff by sight, many by name, and they spoil me whenever I show up. Since I can't safely navigate my way through the throngs of concertgoers, nor travel the length of the world's most famous arena on foot, they provide me with a wheelchair and I spin through the bowels of the building, powered by an MSG escort. I find that I'm actually okay with using a wheelchair now. I see it not as a tyrant, but as a tool. I've managed to live my life without Parkinson's defining me, so I'm no longer troubled by a simple chair with wheels. FDR would not allow himself to be photographed in a wheelchair. Neither would JFK. But I'm over it. I'm not the president of anything. I don't have to worry about Hitler or Castro assessing my vulnerabilities and weaknesses. I'm just a retired actor who wants to go to a concert with his wife and daughters. Roll on. The MSG attendant, whose pushing etiquette is impeccable, stays beside Tracy and the girls at their pace, occasionally lobbing in a little New York Rangers gossip. He delivers us to our section. I rise from the chair to no one's surprise or dismay, a few careful steps up the metal stairway, and I plant my ass in my seat. Mission accomplished. I've come to accept that I take a village. I'm part of the village, too. I contribute in every way I can, and I try to be a solid citizen. I feel fortunate to be here in this place with these people that I love. The effort is 100% worth it. The music, the girls, the hint of pot smoke, and of course, Tracy. Between songs, Esme and Skylar slip out of their seats and soon return with Vampire Weekend bucket hats. They look ridiculous and beautiful. Tracy gives a thumbs up to the hats, never once breaking her rhythm. On her feet the whole night, she's sublimely in sync with the pulse of the concert. It seems more like my girlfriend of 3 weeks than my wife of 31 years. The young crowd sings along with the band, and the whole joint is rocking. I may not be dancing, but I'm standing, and at times white-knuckling the handrail, and I'm singing along. I'm a worse singer than I am a dancer. But fortunately, my sonic dissonance is subsumed by the amplified roar from the stage, from the far reaches of the building, and from the groundlings on the arena floor. The band slides into the opening chords of their current hit, Harmony Hall. I join in on the chorus, with its signature lyric, "I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die. God, tell me about it." I carry that line in my mind now. I hear it in the car on Sirius XM radio, and I still puzzle over its resonance. The question is, which part of the dialectical pronouncement carries the most weight? I don't want to live like this, or I don't want to die. Of course, I'm not taking into account lead vampire Ezra Koenig's meaning, motive, or method, nor his intention in creating the song in the first place, and I'm not going to him for the answer. I'm reminded of the time I played Me and Julio down by the schoolyard with Paul Simon at the Fox Foundation's annual fundraiser. During rehearsal, I hesitated over a lyric. I said to Paul, "It's so cryptic." He looked at me straight-faced and said, "Yes, Michael. Yes, it is." Poets and artists will always answer your questions about meaning with one of their own. Well, what does it mean to you? Don't count them to stick around for your reply. The truth is, I don't want to live like this. But I've found a way to accept the fact that I do. For every perilous trip across a room, when my meds are off and my steps are halting and erratic, there are also times when it all slips away. In those moments, like this night out with my family, I feel joy and contentment. In those moments, I have everything I need. I had been experiencing a temporal compression, attempting to live the past, present, and future all at the same time. The lines were blurred. When I visit the past now, it's for wisdom and experience, not for regret or shame. I don't attempt to erase it, only to accept it. Whatever my physical circumstances are today, I will deal with them and remain present. If I fall, I will rise up. As for the future, I haven't been there yet. I only know that I have one. Until I don't. The last thing we run out of is the future. Really, it comes down to gratitude. I'm grateful for all of it. Every bad break, every wrong turn, and the unexpected losses, because they're real. It puts into sharp relief the joy, the accomplishments, the overwhelming love of my family. I can be both a realist and an optimist. Lemonade, anyone? Epilogue. A not-so-funny thing happened on the way to finishing this book. In the midst of personal introspection, so hyper-focused as to require a dental mirror, the world exploded. Or rather, imploded. Actually, both. After more than a year spent examining my life from an eyeball-to-navel perspective, my worldview was suddenly supersized, looking downward from 30,000 feet at a planet in crisis. The travails and triumphs of one man suddenly seemed insignificant among the struggles of 7 billion people living and dying through a global pandemic. Countries around the globe went into lockdown. We went inside and shut our doors, seeking refuge in quarantine. Yet somehow, existing separate and apart, we all had a shared experience. I never thought of it this way, but for years I've been practicing my own version of social distancing. In my case, the length of an arm plus a cane between myself and others, as a means to protect people from the dangers of me. Frankly, I also kept an emotional distance, as in, you can't relate to my problems. Now I had company in my socially distanced isolation. Everyone kept a safe distance, concerned about their health and that of their friends and family. Whatever our previous issues were, we all now shared the same big problem, and none of us knew what would happen next. Shortly after New York shuttered its businesses, restaurants, and bars and limited the access to services, Trace and I gathered our four children, three of whom were living on their own, and relocated to our summer home on Long Island. We sheltered in place. The six of us had not lived this closely together for years. In many ways, it was an experience I'll never forget. I was thankful to have my family safe and together, and we all found corners of the house in which to work or attend school remotely. We relished our non-work hours to focus on each other, to assemble jigsaw puzzles and watch old movies. Tracy cooked amazing meals, and we lingered around the dinner table, discussing the world and debating politics and social policies. We were aware of the dichotomy of the situation. People infected with the virus were dying alone in hospitals, without the care and comfort of their family at their sides. At the same time, the virus brought families like ours closer to one another, huddled together inside. We were more connected to each other than ever before. Still, there were personal losses and disappointments. My daughter Esme graduated from high school in June, but like most members of the class of 2020, there was no pomp due to the circumstance. She and her classmates had no ceremony to mark the occasion, nor did they attend prom or enjoy any of the other trivialities or formalities that go with finishing high school. Their freshman year of college this year promises to be void of the ordinary rituals and milestones, with none of the open-armed welcome to campus and teary drop-offs by parents. Esme shouldered the loss of these milestones with aplomb. That's not to say she didn't acknowledge the truth. The situation sucked, but she could see that others were suffering in ways that were much worse. I can't be mad at the world for canceling my prom when there are people missing their families, when people are dying, she said. The worst part, the loss of human connection, the inability to say goodbye to school friends and teachers, and the lack of an in-person coda to high school. I don't care about missing events as much as the connections those events would have provided. I really miss sharing those final experiences with the rest of my classmates, she told me as we sat in our backyard on the evening she was supposed to be at her prom. I often describe my mother and father as having been born during the Great Depression and coming of age during World War II. Eerily, Esme's generation is similar to my parents, in that she was born right after 9/11 and is now coming of age during this global pandemic. Her childhood was bookended by these two seminal tragedies, but she and her classmates carried on. I admire this generation, their resilience and positivity in the face of it all. These teenagers have coalesced around hope for a better future, around their shared support for frontline workers, and around marching for social change in this, the strangest summer of their lives. Actually, Esme will have a graduation ceremony after all. Planned for August instead of June, it will take place on a computer screen. It will be virtual. Everything is virtual now. I've had virtual meetings, virtual chats with friends, virtual presentations to the Parkinson's community. Even the recording of this audiobook is virtual. The Oxford English Dictionary obviously understood that this term needed a new second definition. Virtual. Adjective. 1. Almost or nearly as described. 2. In computing, not physically existing as such, but made by software to appear to do so. Last week, I went to a virtual funeral for my very real friend, Nancy Ryder. Nancy was my publicist from my earliest days on Family Ties. I was her first client, among a long list of famous names to follow. Dale loved her as much as I did. Nancy was funny, pushy, loving, terrorizing, and the type of friend you'd want to have your back. About 6 years ago, she was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. I visited Nancy whenever I was in L.A., along with Tracy or Justine Bateman, who was also a client. We'd sit in her Hollywood Hills living room and retell all the old stories. She could still communicate, though after a while only with the use of a boogie board LCD writing tablet. She would type into it, and her virtual voice enunciated her words. Her sense of humor was still sharp, evidence that she typed, "Nobody gets my Prada handbags." Nancy's funeral was held in Los Angeles. I attended from my home in New York. Those gathered at the service were all masked, so that when each appeared in a tiny box on my screen, I couldn't identify the faces. Only eyes and muzzled voices. It's strange that the good guys wear the masks now. Collectively, we have witnessed healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, and frontline workers acting as the true heroes in the onslaught of the pandemic. I sheepishly recall my petulance and obstinance in dealing with my home health aides while I recovered from surgery. Now I realize that these same professionals were likely called into service during the darkest days of New York's ordeal, the terrible months of March, April, and May. I'm grateful for all the brave healthcare workers in our city and farther afield, with a special acknowledgement to those at Mount Sinai and at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore for the risks they took and the sacrifices they made. During our time in quarantine, my family and I would get up from our dinner at 7 o'clock, time with hospital shift changes, and emerge under our front porch. We joined our neighbors, isolated in their own bubbles, and we all banged on pots, blew whistles, and rang cowbells in support of healthcare workers. We could hear the joyful appreciation wafting from the village, down side streets and avenues, a band of thousands sending a message of thanks out to the universe. As things stand now, there remains a level of suffering and fear felt by many people, an uncertainty about their living situations, employment security, children's educations, and the outcomes of this global problem. For those devastated by loss, I hope that in time they find some peace and resolution. As impossible as it is to imagine, there are fragments of hope in the wreckage, as well as things to be grateful for. Indeed, good things can come from bad things. Many families, ours included, were fortunate to discover unexpected and valued time with one another as we face this battle together. We can all take something positive from the class of 2020. To accept what has happened in the past, to embrace the present, and to remain open to the probability that it will get better in the future. I hear echoes of Stephen Pollan in that advice. With gratitude, optimism becomes sustainable. Michael J. Fox, New York City, August 2020. I hope you've enjoyed this production of No Time Like the Future, a Macmillan audio production for Flatiron Books. This title was produced and directed by Guy Oldfield, consulting producer Nell Fortenberry, recorded and engineered by Matt Cruz, post-production by Tim Franklin, text copyright 2020 by Lucky Gus, production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.